Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, Americans are stampeding to file for bankruptcy ahead of the new, more restrictive bankruptcy law that takes effect on Monday. The new law makes it more difficult for consumers and businesses to completely wipe out their debts. And according to a firm that gathers weekly bankruptcy statistics, more than 100,000 bankruptcy filings were recorded across the country last week alone, compared to 30,000 for a typical week. John Penn is president of the American Bankruptcy Institute and a practicing attorney in Fort Worth, Texas. John, here in Boston, we're reading today that 1,000 new bankruptcy cases were filed over the Columbus Day weekend alone. In Kansas City, there were nearly 500 new cases filed on just one day this week. Put this into perspective for us.
Absolutely. It is the biggest change in bankruptcy law in a generation since the bankruptcy code was enacted back in 1978.
Well, as we read the old law, it allowed consumers to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy and either wipe out their debt entirely or abide by a plan to pay off at least some debts if a case reviewer deemed that they could. This new law, as we understand it, would require a means test. Can you explain that?
The philosophy changed somewhat because it was really aimed at identifying debtors who could repay at least some of their debts, and they tried to come up with an objective filter to identify those cases. That's what the means test is meant to do.
So if you make above a certain amount of money and you have a family of a certain size, you're expected to pay back more debt?
You get a second look to see whether you're able to pay back more debt or not.
Yeah.
There's still another couple of steps to go through in the means test to see if you really can repay more debt. So just because you come in over the state's median income does not mean you absolutely will always be moved over into a Chapter 13 repayment plan.
By the way, John, you said a state's median. Does every state have a different median?
Yes, and that's based on the point that is the midpoint if you lined up all of the residents of the state's income. And so you're looking really at the middle point in the income scale for
right.
each state.
So states with less incomes will have a lower median. Well, we understand that the new law makes it tougher for businesses as well to file for bankruptcy. And we just saw the auto parts maker Delphi file to beat the deadline. Before that, the airlines Northwest and Delta. Is there some irony here, John, that this law, which is meant to prevent bankruptcies, may be pushing people into it?
In some respects, yes, but another way to look at it is that the people and the businesses that are filing were already having financial difficulty and so might have filed in the next 6 to 9 months, but instead of waiting, they've just come across to this side of the change.
The banking and credit card industries pushed for this more restrictive code. Was there that much abuse?
Abuse is in the eyes of the beholder. Instead of thinking of it as abuse, it was really more of looking to see if debtors had an ability to pay some, and the feeling apparently was that debtors that could pay at least something were getting all of their debts discharged.
And how do hurricane survivors fit in here? I mean, we understand thousands of people from the Gulf Coast were considering bankruptcy. Will they get some sort of stay?
Part of the means test allows you to show that special circumstances exist in your particular situation so that your historic income shouldn't be counted as such.
Mm-hmm.
And so in all likelihood, the hurricane victims will be able to show that their past income is not indicative of what they're going to have in the future and get some relief that way.
John Penn is president of the American Bankruptcy Institute. He's speaking to us from Fort Worth, Texas. John, thank you.
Thanks.
As Iraqis prepare to vote on a draft constitution this weekend, one journalist is providing a unique view of the people who will cast those ballots. Moscow-based French reporter Anne Novat is known for disappearing into the local culture of places she visits, sleeping in homes, not hotels, eating in people's kitchens rather than restaurants, and traveling by bus and taxi instead of military convoy. In her new book, The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan, we meet a young Kurd whose culture culturally prohibited from marrying his true love, a middle-aged professor who is also an insurgent and quotes the Swedish band ABBA to defend his position, and a young father who admits to cutting off 13 tongues and 40 hands as directed by Saddam Hussein's son. It's fascinating, and journalist Anne Novot is in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm understanding that this is a book that you wrote in the wake of the war, but you have just again returned from Baghdad in Iraq.
That's right.
And compare it to the last time you were there.
Much worse. Things are much worse, and that I'm sad to say that nothing, absolutely nothing, has improved. And all the people I met for this book, the families, the young, the young Kurd you just mentioned in your introduction, who couldn't marry his true love, he's now desperate for leaving the country, and he told me that he would like to go to the most the two countries in the world that are most welcoming immigrants, Canada or Australia. And my friends in Baghdad, also in the capital, Shia friends who are much well off than this young student, Kurd Bilal, they also want to emigrate. They also want to leave the country. And they also mentioned to me Canada and Australia. And I think it's a very bad sign.
We're looking at the referendum on the Constitution. What is your sense of what's going to happen?
Well, I'm sorry to say that this referendum is something that you will hear a lot about in this country, because of the referendum, you will have a bunch of reporters going back to Baghdad, probably embedded with the U.S. Army or staying in the green zone or with secluded in the Sheraton or the hotels of the capital. But that is not the most important preoccupation in the Iraqis' mind. Absolutely not. What people have in mind today is one, electricity. The electricity, they still don't have electricity. And secondly, they have huge problems with oil. When I was there a year and a half ago, they had no problem with oil. And this year, as soon as I crossed the border, I noticed those huge lines of people just staying for hours and hours in very unsafe streets of Baghdad, waiting for gasoline. And
why do you think that is?
I know exactly what it is. On the border in Turkey, you have hundreds, literally hundreds of Turkish tankers waiting in line to cross the border from Turkey to Iraq. There is just one checkpoint. They enter Iraq empty. In Iraq, they buy crude oil. They come, they cross back the border with this crude oil, which they refine in Turkey, because all the refineries, the oil refineries have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. And then they have to come to cross back again in order to sell the oil. Mm. So that means that everything depends on those Turkish drivers. If the Turkish drivers decide for some security reason not to go, of course the price goes up. Mm. And Iraqis are not used to that. And they are absolutely not satisfied with that. And what they think, what they have been, they repeated to me, is that they would much prefer their government to care about oil problems and also about electricity than organizing a referendum for a constitution that no one understands the meaning of, no one has ever read or knows exactly what it is about.
In fact, let's talk about that. And this brings us back to your book. We meet, as you meet in your book, average Iraqis, exceptional Iraqis, professional Iraqis, stay-at-home mothers. And they talk to you in ways that we really, you know, especially in the U.S. press, we haven't heard that much of. You meet one in particular. This is the professor I was speaking of, mm-hmm. who's also a resistance leader, an insurgent.
He is an insurgent, but he's dead now. He was killed, and it's not known by whom.
Well, when you met him, he gave you such insight into why an educated Iraqi might reject exactly what the Americans are pushing for in the referendum. He said, you know, the Prophet Muhammad always asked the advice of his close circle. That's the democracy we want, not the one the Americans want to impose on us. He's also the one who quotes, "The winner takes it all." Right, the ABBA song.
For me, it was very, very funny that such a guy would quote ABBA. And that's why I wrote it in the book.
Well, the point that he was trying to make is the Americans possess the power of weapons, money, the media, and the United Nations. It's our turn. I mean, that was his sense of things.
Yes, and he's not the only one to think this way. What people are appalled by right now in Iraq and also in Afghanistan is that they don't want to have certain values imposed to them, democracy being one of them, but they also have in mind cultural values, television, the sky is open, they all see Western channels through satellite, and what they see, they don't like what they see, because for them we in the West have lost many values that they still have in their countries, such as hospitality, respect towards the elderly, etc. But they are also attracted by our modernity and the technology. So they are very ambiguous.
Well, so you meet the professor insurgent who explains why he's doing that. And by the way, he hates Saddam Hussein.
He does. And he's not the only one. We in the West have a tendency to think that, especially in the so-called Sunni triangle, every insurgent is pro-Saddam Hussein. But all the young guy I met in Fallujah, for example, we're neither nor. And they told me we don't want to go back to Saddam Hussein's rule. The only thing we want is the Americans out.
You remind me again, you met a sheikh at one point who said, why didn't the American soldiers get to know us? I guess they mortared his house because Saddam Hussein was supposed to be hiding there. He said, I could have told them Saddam Hussein killed my cousin. I would never let him in here. That kind of...
There is a feeling, a broad feeling of not being understood, right? And of the Americans not even wanting to understand another society, another civilization. And that is very humiliating for them.
Annie Novotny, you met so many Iraqis, not just on the trip that produced this book, but on your most recent one. Did you meet anyone who said, I feel liberated, I'm so looking forward to participate in that? You're smiling. You didn't...
To participate in what?
In a democracy and voting and...
Well, of course I also meet with people who speak positively, but they cannot speak like that because they don't know what is this democracy we want to bring them. Because of the military presence, because of the insecurity of the insurgency, it's a transitional period. And again, we are going too quickly. So there is sort of a huge misunderstanding about what is democracy.
Journalist Anne Novotny. Her new book is called The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan. And we'll be back with much more in just a minute. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. And now continue our conversation with journalist Anne Novotny, whose new book is entitled The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan, which is the result of Novotny's recent travels in both countries, where she melted into the culture, wore traditional dress, traveled and lived with the local people. And she found people with amazing stories to tell. The bookkeeper who loves U.S. accounting textbooks but is appalled by the Enron scandal. A professor of theater who says the word democracy has no interpretation, no meaning in Iraq. And Anne, you spoke of going to Fallujah. What did you see there?
Well, first of all, it's still very difficult to enter and exit Fallujah because there is a strict entry and in and out regime. The city is supposed to be cleared of the so-called terrorists, of the rebels, insurgents. But the problem is that when you go there to do your job, which is what I did, I met with many of the insurgents. The city is absolutely not cleared of them. So the problem is, and that's what the people told me, the local people, the inhabitants of Fallujah, not only nothing has changed, for them in comparison to 1 year ago, because the events exactly happened. The assault on Fallujah was in November 2004. But it's even worse. Now they have less security. The guerrilla is attacking the U.S. soldiers every day in Fallujah, every day. And I met with a bunch of young men who told me, we will do it again and again and again. And we don't care if you think we are terrorists, fundamentalists, or whatever. We are unified with any kind of groups in Fallujah who want to kick them out. Mm. And the result is that there is no normal life in Fallujah, and as usual, the civilian population is completely trapped.
And Nevat, of course, your greatest interest is in communicating what you saw there, but I just want to ask about you. Because here you are, as you just said, speaking with insurgents in Fallujah, traveling through Iraq in a burqa.
I know, it sounds surreal.
It does. Do you feel
you
the
know
day?
What is surreal for me? What is surreal is to be back here and to be in America right now talking about it when I was there a few days ago. The two worlds are so far from each other. And that is for me, well, of course I will continue doing my job, which is for me essentially being a bridge, being an intermediary between them and us. But believe me, this is becoming more and more difficult every day, not because of the physical difficulties, because of the danger. Of course, this is dangerous and complicated, but psychologically it is becoming almost unbearable for me to see this gap growing between us and them, to see these many misunderstandings that for which I personally don't have explanation for, but I have to continue doing it, because this is, I think, the only way to try to understand a little bit each other better and maybe start some sort of a dialogue. Because the misunderstandings and the gap, of course, lead to terror. And I'm very interested now in getting their image of the situation, because by knowing it, we will be much more efficient in responding to the threat.
And Nevat, she is a French woman who's based in Russia, who has traveled around the world. In fact, at one point was artist in residence here at the Isabella Stewart Museum in Boston. And most recently has been taking her way of reporting to Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we speak to a lot of reporters in Iraq. Even some of the most hardened, experienced reporters say they can't go out anymore. They can't go and meet with people. How is it that you can?
Because it's wrong that they cannot go out. It's completely wrong. You can always go
but
out.
But we see reporters, we see people kidnapped,
beheaded.
You just
need to, well, I've been doing this job for many years now. I've not been kidnapped. I'm sorry to say, but I've not been kidnapped. This is doable. In order to do it, you need first to want it. Secondly, you need to follow some rules, some very strict rules.
Such as?
I go by myself. I travel throughout the country with local people. I am dressed like a local woman. I am, of course, not staying in hotels. Never, which is what usually journalists do. They do stay in hotels.
You sleep on mats in people's homes. And
I sleep only in people's homes, only because their security is my security. Mm. And I think by building this trust between me and the family, this is the best of securities. But I'm not blaming all the reporters for doing what they are doing. Everybody does what he thinks is the best. It's just that my method requires more time. What I'm trying to do is to give to the public the other side of the story. Mm. They already got the side that is the official voices, etc., from the Green Zone, from the U.S. point of view, etc., from the journalists embedded with the U.S. Army. I'm trying to get the other side of the story.
Mm. And Nevat, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Journalist Anne Nevat, her new book is called The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, today President Bush gave some soldiers in Iraq his view of the war. In a pep talk via video conference from the White House, he told the soldiers that they have tremendous support among Americans and that, in his words, the U.S. put in motion something that cannot be stopped, the March of Freedom.
I want you to know that the mission you are on is vital to achieving peace and to protecting America.
Lieutenant Greg Murphy from Tennessee told President Bush that this weekend's referendum vote on a draft Iraqi constitution will be a joint U.S.-Iraqi success.
On Saturday, sir, we're going to be beside them. We're going to be there to support them through anything. But we can't wait to share in their success with them on Sunday.
And the president wrapped up by telling the soldiers, if I'm hanging around, come by and say hello once they get back to the States. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now, and we've been looking this week at changes in child care. Today, the National Dialogue on Diapers. About 2,000 people across the country have thrown away diapers in favor of very early toilet training. The diaper-free movement has a website, internet groups, and a how-to book that sold 50,000 copies. We'll hear from child development expert Dr. T. Barry Brazelton in a moment, but first, Here and Now producer Kevin Sullivan takes a look at the diaper-free movement from the perspective of a new dad.
Ever since my son Jackson was born 8 months ago, I've suddenly become that dad, the one who can't help but talk about baby bodily functions. My wife Lucia warmly advises me, folks don't want to hear about Jack going number two. Anyway, these days, Jack moves around so much, just getting a diaper on him can be a tug of war.
Here, Kevin, help. Just grab his leg. Just keep him in place.
So when I heard about parents who got rid of diapers by picking up on their infant's cues through a technique called elimination communication, I wondered, what's Jack trying to tell me? I decided to visit Christine Babb in Framingham, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you?
Her 6-month-old daughter, Beatrice, has become something of a poster child for elimination communication. She's even peed on Good Morning America.
The signals that she gives you are just one more thing that you have to observe and react to. Just like you react to their need to eat or sleep, when they're fussy, when they're bored.
Now, you are using a diaper. I thought
yes.
The whole point was that you didn't need diapers.
No, you can do elimination communication in a variety of ways. You can go completely bare-bottomed. You can use diapers as a backup. You know, I don't relish getting peed on like anyone else.
Christine's house looks just like ours with all the baby gadgets. There's a pack and play, musical stuffed animals, and the ubiquitous teething rings. But she also has something we don't.
It's a conventional potty seat.
It looks like just a big white plastic bowl to me, but Beatrice seems to know what it's used for.
Just taking off her diaper and giving her what a lot of people refer to as a potty-tunity, just a chance to use the potty. She may or may not be into it. Psst, psst, psst. Psst, psst, psst. See, when she arches her back, she says, that's it. Not interested. Thanks, but no thanks.
So what are some of the cues that Beatrice gives you?
Beatrice gets very quiet. She sort of has that little far-off look like she's contemplating.
What's she telling you now?
I think she might be teething. She's just chewing on my thumb there.
My wife first told me about this EC technique, and we've been talking to all our new parent friends about it. And the consensus is those people are crazy. They're just nuts. Why would anyone ever do that?
I got the same reaction when I started homeschooling my son years ago. But I've pointed them to information about it. And once they've learned that, you know, this is not something new, it's new for Western society. In the last 100, 150 years, we've really moved away from children being having toilet independence at a younger age. In fact, it's actually getting into quite extended ages now. I think the median age for boys is something like 39 months, and that's, you know, well into 3 years. So to me, it just makes sense. I'm not doing anything to her. I'm simply, you know, giving her an opportunity to eliminate in a place where I want her to eventually.
With all this talk, I had to take my own break and missed out on Beatrice's big moment.
Okay, so what happened while I was gone here?
She used the potty. She was just sitting there and, you know, heard a little tinkle.
Now, aren't you afraid, now she's bare-bottomed, aren't you afraid she's just going to pee on you?
Well, if you think about what just happened, she just went. And if you think about how adults go, we don't have to, usually, don't have to go immediately afterwards. But I would consider myself, quote, safe for, you know, a good 20 minutes or so, you know, unless she, you know, does a number two.
Christine points out that 22 billion disposable diapers end up in landfills annually, and they cost the average parent about $3,000 a year. But still, a child peeing every 20 to 25 minutes can keep a parent running
Baby
in circles.
Up to the sky.
Christine works part-time and says everyone should make their own choice.
Right. Since there's no standard of parenting, everyone's parenting is an indictment of everyone else's. And so the choices that are right for one family may not be right for another. I certainly would recommend that a family that was very uptight about it, overstressed, not use it.
Uptight? Overstressed? Sorry, Jack. Looks like it's diapers for you.
Producer Kevin Sullivan visiting with Christine Babb in Framingham, Massachusetts. And for the record, when she does use the diapers, Christine uses cloth, not disposable. Well, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton is the author of Toilet Training the Brazelton Way. He also helped Pampers develop pull-up diapers for older kids. Dr. Brazelton, what do you think of this so-called elimination communication with infants?
Well, it's nothing new, you know. All primitive tribes carry their babies on their sides and take them out in the yard or hold them out. The only thing that worries me about it, because I think it's a wonderful way of communicating with your baby, is most women just can't do that. Mm-hmm. 60 to 70% of women are in the workforce, and I think it's unnecessary for them to feel guilty if they can't do it. And I think we value independence and the child learning each stage by themselves as exciting for them. So I think that plays into it too.
Do infants even have the physical capability of stopping themselves from going to the bathroom? In other words, training themselves? Or is this something that if parents start it when they have an infant, they need to know it's going to go on for years?
Well, I think it's mothers getting trained, not babies getting trained. If it's babies getting trained, I would worry a lot more about the eventual sort of rebellion that child might do when they finally got voluntary control. Most of what we know about babies learning from reflex behavior, which is what I think it must be in the first year, shows that when they get into voluntary behavior and get control over it themselves, they say, hey, I didn't want to do that. I'm going to take over myself.
In that what, a two-year-old may decide, you know what, I'm not going to make it to the toilet.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, what would you suggest if that happens when a child is two or three? Should they just throw on some diapers and not push the child?
Oh, yeah. I think pull back and say, look, when you're ready, you do it yourself, and fall into the same adaptation we've fallen into for all kids. Mm. Otherwise, I think they might run into a lot of withholding of bowels and bedwetting, the sort of thing that we used to see a lot of.
Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, author of Toilet Training the Brazelton Way. Thanks for speaking with us.
Well, Robin, it's great to hear you.
And this Nobel news note, 75-year-old British playwright Harold Pinter has won the Nobel Prize in Literature. His works include The Room, The Birthday Party, and The Caretaker. Pinter makes art out of spare language and unbearable silence, but he's seldom quiet on issues. Here he is lashing out at theater critics on the BBC show Hard Talk.
I find critics, on the whole, a pretty unnecessary bunch of people, actually. I much prefer the immediate correspondence between a play and its audience. Although sometimes it's very uncomfortable and unpleasant experience, particularly in this country, where people really don't like the theatre very much, I think.
playwright Harold Pinter, today's recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature, outspoken as always. You're listening to Here and Now. As bad as it gets, a black eye on the sport. Even in a place where dead men have been known to vote, this will rank as one of the most shocking endings ever to a baseball game with national implications. Sports writers are going nuts today over an umpire's call in last night's Chicago White Sox win over the Los Angeles Angels in Game 2 of the American League Championship Series. And NPR's Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, joins us in the studio with more. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
The Chicago Tribune's Mike Downey called last night a climax as thrilling and unexpected and absurd as anything an Oscar-winning scriptwriter could come up with. Chicago writers, of course, a little happier with the ending. What happened?
Okay, now listen carefully, Robin, because this is the most important thing that you'll hear today. Possibly this week, possibly in your lifetime.
Hardly, but...
A.J. Pierzynski of the White Sox apparently strikes out in the ninth inning, apparently ending the inning. Josh Paul, the Angels catcher, apparently catches the ball.
Right.
Doug Eddings, the umpire, apparently calls Pierzynski out since it is strike three. And then it gets very confusing. Paul maintains that since umpire Eddings did not say no catch, no catch, which umpires sometimes say, Josh Paul says, always say when the third strike hits the ground, or either because the catcher drops it or because it hits the ground before it hits his glove, that's how the catcher knows that the play isn't over, so he must either tag the batter or throw the ball to first.
Okay, so the discrepancy is whether or not the catcher caught the ball or it hit the ground.
Well, there are a couple of discrepancies. One is, did the catcher catch the ball or did it hit the ground before he caught it, or did he trap it on the ground?
In which case,
if the umpire had clearly made the call no catch, no catch, then presumably the catcher would have either tagged the batter or thrown the ball to first.
But instead,
he assumed that since there was no call, strike three stood, and he rolled the ball back out to the pitcher's mound, which was a perfectly natural thing to do since it was time for the next inning to begin.
And the batter.
You can't fault A.J. Pierzynski. He simply did what any athlete is trained to do. Take advantage of the situation. Hey, nobody said anything. I'm going to run to first.
And
what have I got to lose?
So he runs to first. There's a big brouhaha, but he stays. They say that it was legal what he did.
Absolutely.
And it ends up he ends up being the winning run when he's driven in a couple of innings
now,
later.
Yeah, now, it's safe to say the Angels had to give up a walk and a double also. This guy couldn't have won Pierzynski couldn't have won the game all by himself simply by going to first. They had to get him the rest of the way around with a winning run. They did. 1-1 in games. Off we go.
Well, huge brouhaha over the win last night. We have a White Sox fan on the line, Paul Bray of Windsor, North Carolina. He wrote us recently, Bill. And Paul, you confessed that you cried after hearing us talk about Red Sox fans last year when they won the World Series. Why did that touch you so much?
Well, all the stories of, I think, particularly fathers bonding with their children and many of them dying, in fact, before seeing the Red Sox win the series.
And as a White Sox fan, you could relate.
Well, absolutely. In fact, my early memories with my father was at the White Sox game, kind of a sad situation. He became chronically ill with Parkinson's disease when I was about 14. And so really my last real good conversations with him were at the ballpark of the White Sox.
Well,
a long time ago.
Well, and as you wrote in your email, you know, White Sox fans get no publicity, no emotion from
nothing,
nothing, as the Red Sox do. But now you do. I'm wondering, after last night's game, there's a lot of negative publicity.
Yeah, well, there sure is. But, you know, I mean, umpires call them both ways, don't they?
Well, Paul Bray, in the minds of many people, when they think of the White Sox, the only thing they think of is 1919 and
right.
Throwing the game. So what would you want people to know about your White Sox?
Well, you know, we're a gritty team that run, take chances.
And you cheat. Oh, no, just kidding.
Well, you know, now we didn't pay off the or anything like that. I mean, we didn't.
Paul Bray, thanks so much, and hang in there.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Bill Littlefield, White Sox won in 1917, accused of throwing the game in 1919. Just tell us, do you think, though, despite this controversial call last night, are they playing well enough to win?
Well, they're certainly playing well enough to win, and their manager is a genius, because when Ozzie Guillen was asked what he felt about this play, he said, gee, I didn't see it. I was looking at my lineup card, and it doesn't get any better than that.
Smart move. NPR's Bill Littlefield, host of Only a Game. And hear about what else is happening in the world of sports on his program this weekend. And stay with us. We'll have much more ahead here and now. For now, when MIT professor Alan Lightman was 16, his aunt performed an intervention of sorts. She gave him the book The Scientific Endeavor, the collected writings of Nobel Prize-winning scientists.
The aunt was not unfamiliar with my wayward scientific investigations. On one occasion, I had caused a small fire in the house with an unfortunate mix of chemicals, and I suspect she was hoping that I would expend my raging science drive on reading rather than in experimenting. Her wishes were granted. I was completely mesmerized by this book.
Alan Lightman on reading The Scientific Endeavor when he was a kid. The result? A life of writing, numerous essays, reviews, the novels, Einstein's Dreams, and The Diagnosis. And now he's the editor of a book sure to inspire a new generation, The Best American Science Writing 2005. And Professor Lightman joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
First, tell us, what to you makes good science writing? What ignited your passion, along with your house, apparently, when you were young? What makes it good?
Well, I think, like many other kinds of writing, it should be provocative, it should be intelligent, it should be funny, where the humor is not strained, it should be graceful, and it should be informative.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I wouldn't have thought immediately of those things, but then as I, you know, page through this new compilation, there's love. Oliver Sacks writes about loving the periodic table, and there's intrigue. Two scientists sort of fight over the same aging research. So it is all in there. And you also write that those scientists who have done science writing historically have been sort of frowned on by the science community.
Yes. There really has been a renaissance of science writing by scientists in the early 1960s. There was still quite a taboo against scientists spending their precious, valuable research time writing for the public. It was looked at as kind of a sissyish waste of time.
Who's spending time with the great unwashed.
That's right. Then around 1968, Jim Watson wrote The Double Helix. Carl Sagan came on the scene in the early 70s, Lewis Thomas, Stephen Jay Gould in the late 70s, Steven Weinberg, and by this time it was getting to be a respectable occupation when unquestionably great scientists were spending part of their time talking to the public. And that's sort of when I got into the game in the early 1980s.
And you make a distinction about science writing. You prefer public science writing to popular science writing. What's that distinction for you?
Popular connotes dumbing down, talking down to the reader. And I think good science writing can always be done with a respect for the reader's intelligence. And that's why I prefer the word public to popular.
Well, let's talk about some of the public reading that you've assembled in this book. We mentioned Oliver Sacks, who writes about loving, as a child, the periodic tables,
yes,
and as two new elements are added, which my mind still cannot wrap around that, that there's a new table. What did you like about the essay? Tell us about it.
One thing I love about his piece here is he talks about something called the island of stability, which is certain chemical elements that have not yet been discovered, but we feel that when we do discover those elements, they will be very stable and last a long time without radioactive decay. And he describes it sort of like the Holy Grail. I mean, something that chemists have been longing for decades. And it sort of captures for me the romance of science.
I'm reading a paragraph. He speaks about the new element, which is now called 115, As I write, I have a lump of bismuth in front of me, prismatic and terraced like a miniature Hopi village, and glittering with iridescent oxidation colors. I cannot help wondering whether super bismuth, if it could be obtained in massive form, would be as beautiful, or perhaps more so. He is in love.
He's in love, and he has these samples of chemical elements, and I visited him once in his apartment in Greenwich Village. And he was just dying to take out these big lumps of element samples with very strange densities and colors and put them in my hands and let me feel them.
Ooh. Well, let's turn to some of the other stories that are here, because some of them explain to the reader things that I don't think I could ever understand otherwise. Why don't you pick out one that you've liked?
One essay that I like very much in this book is called The Genome in Black and White and Gray by Robin Morantz Hennig. And she is writing about a new drug called Bidil. And this is the first drug to be ethnic-based.
Right. It's specifically for African-Americans with heart failure.
That's right. And the drug companies in researching this drug may have to explore the differences in different racial groups. And, of course, that's a very sensitive issue. For many years, there have been people who have said that there's no real genetic differences in racial groups other than the very superficial qualities like skin color. There are other scientists who believe that there are some fundamental genetic differences. And just the exploration of a drug that is more effective on one racial group or another opens the door for all of that kind of discussion.
She goes on to point out, if people have their genomes researched, what happens when a black client discovers that there's white in his genome? And she points out a story of one black man who discovered just that. And she poses a question, what is this man, the race he has always thought himself to be or the race his genome says he is? I mean,
yes.
She raises intriguing questions.
Yes. To me, this is an element of good science writing when the writer is able to go beyond the science and look at all of the human implications.
Which is done in the essay. I just want to point out this one essay, although this topic I find so difficult. This essay was entitled Creepy Crawly Care, and it's about maggots,
yes.
An ancient medicinal procedure being used in modern times. How are maggots being used now?
Maggots are able to digest dead and infected tissue. This is how they make their living. Physicians have found that if maggots are placed on certain kinds of damaged tissue, like skin ulcers and bed sores, which are beginning to decay, that the maggots are very effective, in fact, more effective than chemicals you can take off the shelf in the laboratory. Maggots are very effective at removing this dead tissue.
Yeah, and this article was written for Science News by Ben Harder. And, you know, he has people saying, hey, it worked.
Yes.
You know, looking into the future, is there some trend in science writing that's appealing to you? Is there?
I think there is a trend that we're trying to encourage in our graduate program in science writing at MIT, and that is not for science writing to be simply cheerleading. Science writers are not just cheerleaders for science. They are people who can take a critical stance on science and on the institutions that support science, on the scientists who practice science, so that it's more of an analytical look at how science is done, how it fits within the public at large, all the issues that are brought in around science. And that's what we are trying to encourage in our young science writers.
Alan Lightman is the editor of the new book, The Best American Science Writing 2005. It's the best of the year 2004. He also is the author of many books and writings of his own, including Einstein's Dreams. Alan Lightman, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.